That was a very valuable contribution, and we all appreciate it greatly. My next panelist is... I didn't say agree, I just said appreciate. Our next panelist is Professor Ernest Vandenhaag, both a psychoanalyst and a noted social critic. He's a lecturer in psychology and sociology at the New School for Social Research and adjunct professor of social philosophy at New York University. He's written a great many books and articles on a wide range of social problems, most recently political violence and civil disobedience in 1972, and a book called Punishing Criminals, which has just been published, I think, which you've seen outside. Professor Vandenhaag.
Professor Curlin has said all the things that I would want to say, only he said them better. So I need add very little to that. Occasionally, I think he went farther than I would have, as when he said that Congress is all but impotent. I wish it were, but when I look at what Congress did with respect to Angola, or what it does in spending my money on food stamps, I find it is not as impotent as I wish it should be. Still, I agree with the sentiment. I also agree with Mr. Curlin's idea that we are in danger to enter what Alex Bickel used to call a legalitarian society, a society not run by laws, but by people who pretend to interpret the law, and instead of restraining bureaucratic inroads, have colluded with the bureaucrats to regulate our life far more than is necessary. I would also add another gloss that not only do I agree that the cases, the multitude of cases that the courts handle, has been brought about by them, by their own tendency to insist that they should regulate our life in details our founding fathers never thought of. I may add that the courts not only regulate too much, but they take an enormous amount of time. Our trials take much longer than trials in any other civilized country, particularly countries trials say in England, where the longest criminal trial, to my knowledge, took 40 days, and it was regarded as very exceptional. Our trials, 3, 6 months, and so on, are quite usual. And there's no evidence that the result is any better than it is in England. I also agree with respect to the abortion decision, where the court so narrowed the rights and duties of the states in regulating abortion that in effect what the Supreme Court did is to write an abortion statute for the states. And I want to note that it is with great indignation, to take a more recent case, that many people have greeted the fact that the court recently, I think last week, decided that the states should be able to keep the right to prohibit homosexual acts instead of declaring any state regulation of such acts or prohibition altogether unconstitutional. I'm not at all sure that the states are wise in exercising their right to regulate these acts or to prohibit them, but I'm convinced that they have this right. And in this connection, I'd like to quote something that may be of some interest to you. An early statute as follows. Whosoever shall be guilty of rape, polygamy, sodomy with man or woman, shall be punished, if a man by castration, if a woman by cutting through the cartilage of her nose a hole of 1/2 inch in diameter at the least. It goes on. This is a direct quotation from a bill to proportion crimes and punishment proposed by Thomas Jefferson in 1779. to the Virginia legislature. It does seem that Thomas Jefferson, who after all was among the founding fathers, had very different notions than the Supreme Court has lately had as to what the states can and cannot do. And I may add, had very different notions also as to what consists is cruel and unusual punishment. While expanding judicial government, it is noteworthy, and I do wish to draw your attention to the fact, that the courts have, and curiously enough, also tacitly abdicated what used to be regarded as a proper function for them to exercise, namely the infliction and the decision on the extent, according to law, of criminal punishments. At first, our judges were all too eager and all too willing to have mandatory fixed sentences replaced by discretionary ones, the discretion being given to them. The idea was that the punishment would fit the criminal, if not the crime. Of course, the reality was that the punishment fitted the judge. However, and this is what I want to draw to your attention, almost without public notice, the judges who had replaced the law in the infliction of punishment were themselves replaced by parole boards. I recently shared a ride in a limousine. We went together to debate at some college with the man who defended Carl Armstrong in Wisconsin. Carl Armstrong was found guilty in Wisconsin, having been defended by William Künstler, of having blown up a science laboratory there with a man in it who died. I spoke with Künstler and I teased him a little bit, as is my habit, because Künstler had insisted, after his client had been found guilty, on a nearly 4 weeks long pre-sentencing hearing in which all kinds of people testified to the virtue and wisdom of the defendant in blowing up that science laboratory, after which the judge gave him 23 years. Naturally, I said to Künstler, well, that's a very interesting defense, and so on. But I had not realized the comeback. Künstler said to me, and I found since that he was entirely right, it doesn't mean anything. He will be released about this year. That's about 2 years ago. And so I said, what do you mean? 23 years, and it's only 2 years. Whereupon he disclosed to me what I should have known, that in Wisconsin, the parole board can release anybody anytime. So whatever the judge says, the parole board can release him right away if it wishes. This is the case in some states. In a greater number of states, there are minima. That is, the sentence is, I don't know, 20 years, and you have to serve, for instance, for a life sentence. In Florida, you have to serve 6 months minimum, which is better, I guess, than it is in Wisconsin. But still, it doesn't seem quite good enough to me. So it seems to me that when judges these days pronounced sentences, they're really deceiving themselves and the public. The real sentence is determined by the parole board. Now, the trouble with parole boards is that nobody has ever found or indicated that parole boards are more competent than the law is, or the interpreter of the law, in deciding what punishment is deserved for what act is just, or what punishment is likely to deter others from committing the act. What parole boards are supposedly competent in, and what they think themselves competent in, is to decide one question and one question alone. Namely, will the convict, upon release, still be a danger to society, or is he, according to the parole board, sufficiently rehabilitated to be safely released? Now, there are two things to be said about that. First, parole boards don't know that any better than you and I. And there is no such thing, as far as we know, as rehabilitation. People do come out of prison more or less the way they come in. And there is no evidence that any rehabilitative system anywhere, not only in the United States, but in Sweden and elsewhere, has ever had any effect whatsoever. But this is not the point. The point that I'm trying to make is very simple. If this is the criterion, and I can't see that the parole board would have any other criterion, then indeed it is perfectly reasonable to release Mr. Armstrong. Probably he will not engage in other illegal acts. As a matter of fact, it would be entirely reasonable to release quite a number of criminals whose crimes are, in the nature of the matter, so to speak, non-recurrent. If a man gets very mad at his wife or has a very impossible wife and kills her, chances are he won't kill any other wives, he might never get to be married, and so on. So the purpose, clearly, if the purpose is rehabilitation, we might just as well release him right away or after very minor punishment. The reason for punishing such a man, seems to me, is twofold. On the one hand, we feel that his act deserves punishment. That is, that it is just that he be punished. And that is what the law says. The law says if you kill your wife, you get X years of prison. It's a promise that the law makes, or a threat, and promises, of course, remain credible and are acceptable as moral obligations only if they are kept. But the second reason why we would want to punish the wife killer is certainly not to rehabilitate him, but it is to intimidate, deter, or restrain other husbands who might be tempted, as I'm told husbands often are, from doing what they did. In other words, we want to keep a few wives alive. Now, it seems to me that if we are asking only, is the man rehabilitated, then clearly our whole structure of punishments makes no sense whatsoever. And it seems to me here, and this is what I wanted to draw to your attention as clearly as I could, that judges, while I agree with Professor Curland, they have become imperial as well as imperious and imperialists. They have invaded territories, gone beyond their mandates in many ways, have become administrators, have replaced legislators, and so on. All of this I would fully agree, but I do wish to draw to your attention that in other respects they have been willing to tolerate being deprived of what I always thought was the basic function in criminal law of a judge, namely to, upon finding of guilt, mete out to the offender the punishment that the law says he deserves. That our judges have given up doing. Thank you.